I was thinking back to the late 1980s, early 1990s, after college, and I was in the military, and I would often go to the local mall. You remember malls, right? Big place to store. And in the mall at that time, there was this store called Successories. I don't know if any of you remember, and they would have these giant posters, and they were these fancy, like a rowing team or someone climbing a mountain or a runner, and it had these inspirational quotes on it. It would encourage you to do all sorts of amazing things. But down from Successories, there was another store called Spencer Gifts. And Spencer had all these crazy things. But they also had posters. And some of them were like black light posters. But there was one particular brand of posters, I remember. There were these posters with cats on them. I don't know if any of you remember these posters with cats on them. And one of the most famous ones is this one here, with the cat sitting there hanging. It's like, hang in there, baby. And it's this picture of what it's like. And sometimes in the Christian life, we feel like we're just given the cat poster. We're going through hard times. We're struggling in our faith a little bit. We're a little bit discouraged. Maybe we're facing some conflict, some persecution. And we feel like we come to church on Sunday morning and the pastor just says, hang in there, baby. You've got this. But in today's message, I want us to think about a little bit more than that, because the Christian message, the message of Jesus, is something more than just hang in there. It's more than that. And so today is Palm Sunday, as Susan said, as we wave the palm branches and we think about what Jesus experienced on that day. So Jesus rides into Jerusalem. He's been teaching and preaching, and he's on his way to Jerusalem knowing he's going to die that week. And he rides in, and the crowds are waving the palm branches. But throughout that week, he experiences some of the lowest moments of his time on earth. He's betrayed by one of his closest followers. He's executed. His followers, who promise they will stay with him, flee at those last moments. And then we can think about the crowd. There's this crowd of people who are waving Hosanna. And later in the week, we don't know if it's the same people, but there's a crowd of people calling crucify him. And so there's this shift, and there's this sense of doubts and wondering. And so as we enter into Holy Week, as we enter into this week of reflecting on all those events, I want us to think about the question, how do we follow Jesus when it gets hard? Because if we're honest with ourselves, it is hard sometimes. It's hard because of things going on in our life. It's hard because of things that people are saying to us. It's maybe hard because we're trying to figure things out. Maybe we have doubts. We're not sure about what's happening. We're not sure how we understand. And so the letter to the Hebrews is all about that very issue. And so this week, if you've been reading along with Immerse, we read the letter to the Hebrews. And the letter to the Hebrews is, a lot of scholars think, a sermon given to a group of followers of Jesus, early followers of Jesus, who were struggling against persecution, who were struggling against doubts, who were struggling with difficulties in what it looks like to follow Jesus. Now, I remember one of the first times I read the book of Hebrews. It's a hard book to read, but it's in the terms of the other letters in the New Testament, one of the harder ones, because it assumes you know a lot about the Old Testament. It assumes you know the story of Moses. It assumes you know the story of wanderings in the wilderness. It assumes you know the stories of Abraham, all these stories together. And we'll get to some of those in a moment, but one of the things is the assumption is this church was facing persecution. It was facing struggles, and so the writer, the preacher, we'll call him, offers, because we don't know who wrote the letter of Hebrews, most likely not Paul, so we're not sure, to this anonymous writer, we'll call him the preacher, gave this message, and he wanted us, first he pointed out Jesus, and he goes through this whole round of how Jesus is greater. Jesus is greater than the angels. Jesus is greater than Moses. Jesus is greater than the priest. Jesus is greater than the sacrifice. And he offers them a challenge to remain faithful despite persecution and trouble. And I think it's a good message for us too, because discouragement, weariness can come to us. And so what the writer does, what the preacher does, is he kind of alternates. He'll give this exposition, a story, and then he moves to exhortation, which is kind of like, here's the encouragement, here's what you need to do with it. He talks about who Jesus is, how he's greater than, and then he gives encouragement, examples. And the basic idea of the letter, in some sense, is that endurance is related to the health of our relationship to Jesus and faithful obedience. That's where we draw our endurance, our relationship to Jesus and faithful obedience. So we're going to pick up in the end of chapter 4 that John read in the beginning of chapter 5. So the first couple chapters of Hebrews, we kind of set the stage. It says Jesus is greater than the angels. We think of angels, and angels we think of, we have all kinds of pictures in our minds, but angel is simply the Greek word for messenger. So it's not a particular, and so it's saying Jesus is the greatest of all the messengers. And so if he's greater than the messengers, he's got the greatest message of all. And if his message is great, then we have to pay attention to this message. If it's the most important message, we have to pay attention to it. And then if he's greater than the angels, how amazing is it that he died for us? Then in chapters 3 and 4, he picks up how Jesus is greater than Moses. And we did a whole bunch with that last week, but he's even more explicit this week. And his main point is God's people had been in slavery in Egypt. And this is all the backstory of the Old Testament. God's people have been in slavery in Egypt. God sends Moses to be a deliverer. Moses brings them out of slavery. They escape from slavery. They're out in the desert, the wilderness, on their way to the land of promise. And on the way there, they turn against Moses. Like, Moses, what are you doing? Why'd you bring us here? We were better off back there. You know, how far is it? How much longer, Moses? What are we? They go against Moses. And the writer, the preacher's point is, if Jesus is greater than Moses, then the stakes are even higher if we rebel against Jesus. Because when they rebelled against Moses, they weren't able to enter into the land of promise. And so in the same way, if we rebel against Jesus, we're not able to enter into the rest that God provides. And so that brings us to the passage I want to focus on today, is the end of chapter 4. And this last final verses of chapter 4 is kind of a turning point. It looks back and it introduces us to all that happens in basically through chapter 10 of the letter. So a big section of the letter is introduced with this. And so this is what the writer says again. He says, "So then, since we have a great high priest who has entered heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to what we believe. This high priest of ours understands our weaknesses, for he faced all the same testings we do, yet he did not sin. So let us come boldly to the throne of our gracious God. There we will receive his mercy, and we'll find grace to help us when we need it most." And so he begins this exposition on the high priest. And the key point he's saying is that Jesus is the high priest, which means we should or we can hold to our faith and approach the throne. So Jesus is high priest. Anybody, what do you know about a high priest? I mean, if you think of like, if I were to just say, tell me what you know about the high priest. Anything? He has authority, okay. He speaks to God for the people. It's probably, you think maybe like, okay, he's probably got a fancy, or he's the high priest, so he's got this fancy robe, and you go back. But that was one of the jobs of the priest, was this intermediary. The people would offer sacrifices, and then the priest would bring them into the holy part of the tabernacle, the holy part of the temple, and offer them to God. He was the one, he was the go-between. And it would be easy to go back, and you could go back to the book of Leviticus and go back there and find all the details about it and all these things. And you can learn about the Ummim and the Thummim. He had this fancy breastplate with these things that would help him to see and to understand things. But the good news for all of you is you don't need to know all those details. You don't need to be able to sketch the clothing of the high priest or tell all the details. But what we need to know is the high priest was the one who provided access to God. So we can imagine the temple. When they're in the desert, it's a tabernacle floating thing, but when they arrive, they build this giant temple, and the temple is this kind of series of concentric circles, and at the center is the Holy of Holies. And in the Holy of Holies is the Ark of the Covenant, and in the Ark of the Covenant represented the place where God sat on earth. It was this intersection. It was the hot spot for God. And here's where he was. But only the high priest could enter there, and once a year, and the other priests could come closer. And so the people were gathered around, so the only way to connect or to access God was through the high priest. The high priest was the go-between. And if you envision that, you envision a holy of holy with an ark in it and with curtains all around it. And you're one of the people who's way in the outer courts. What's happening? God is kind of what? He's hidden, right? He's closed off from most people. The high priest can go in there, but you can't. You can't go right into the presence of God. The high priest can do that, but only after special preparation and only at certain times. And so we're starting to think, oh, here's this high priest. And then we're going to look a little bit at chapter 5, kind of go quickly through that section because it lays some of the foundation and then come back to those. So chapter 5 of Hebrews, and in your immersed Bible, it's the bottom of page 373. And so the first section says this, because we want to learn a little bit about the high priest, because it helps us understand who Jesus is. So it says, every high priest is a man chosen to represent other people in their dealings with God. He presents their gift to God and offers sacrifices for their sins. So that's what the high priest did. He would offer the sacrifices for people. And he's able to deal gently with ignorant and wayward people. Don't you like that? And he's like, oh, there's the high priest. In other words, everybody else, the ignorant, wayward people, because he himself is subject to the same weaknesses. So he makes the point, the priest is ignorant and wayward too. I mean, he gets what it's like to be those things. And it says, this is why he must offer sacrifices for his own sins as well as theirs. So the high priest, before he would go in, he didn't just take the people's sacrifice. He had to offer a sacrifice himself. He didn't look and say, well, I'm good. I haven't done anything wrong. He said, no, I've got to offer sacrifices for myself and atone for my own sins, have them purified and washed away. Then I can take your sacrifices in. Then he says, and no one can become a high priest simply because he wants such an honor. There was no volunteer sheet at the back of the synagogue saying, who wants to be a high priest? First of all, because we know that back then it worked the same way as today. If you put up a sheet for people to volunteer, probably wouldn't get anybody, right? But that's not where we didn't get it, because he must be called by God for this work, just as Aaron was. Aaron, who was Aaron? Aaron was the brother of Moses, the first, the line of the priest. So what do we learn? The priest comes from the people. He represents the people. His weaknesses enable him to identify and deal gently with the people, because he goes through the same things. And he's appointed by God, which leads to verses 5 through 6. It says, that is why Christ did not honor himself by assuming he could become high priest. No, he was chosen by God, who said to him, you are my son, today I have become your father. So Jesus as high priest, like the other high priest, is appointed by God. And he says, and in another passage, God said to him, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. We'll come back to this guy in a minute, okay? So why was he appointed? So it says, while Jesus was here on earth, he offered prayers and pleadings with a loud cry and tears to the one who could rescue him from death. And God heard his prayers because of his deep reverence for God. So God's hearing him because of his meanings. But he says, even though Jesus was God's son, he learned obedience from the things he suffered. So Jesus was appointed, his role as high priest comes in part because of his obedience, because of endurance, because of his suffering. And then it says, in this way, God qualified him as a perfect high priest, and he became the source of eternal salvation for all those who obey him. And God designated him to be a high priest in the order of Melchizedek. Okay, here, there's that guy. And if you read through the book of Hebrews, you keep hearing about this guy, Melchizedek. He's not terribly important for today, but we're just going to say a brief little detour about Melchizedek. So all of you are familiar with the story of Melchizedek, correct? Melchizedek, back in Genesis 14, there's a bit of a summary in Hebrews, but back in chapter 14 of the book of Genesis, we have Abraham. And who was Abraham? Abraham was the man called by God to be the beginning of the nation of Israel. So this is before Moses, way before all that. So God picks Abraham to be the one through whom he's going to bless the world. Abraham has a son, has a nephew named Lot. Lot doesn't always do the best thing. Lot gets in a war with a bunch of people, and Abraham comes and rescues him. And after that, there's a man named Melchizedek who comes out to meet Abraham. Now, Melchizedek is not just a man. He's the priest, or actually, he's a king. He's both. He's the king of the local city of Salem, or what later becomes the city of Jerusalem. So we hear those words together, Jerusalem, Salem. So the king of Jerusalem comes out to meet Abraham, and Melchizedek is also a priest of the high God. In other words, he's a priest of God. Now, how he found out about all this, we don't know. He's a priest of God. He comes to Abraham, and he gives Abraham a blessing. And so the idea is, who blesses who? Normally, it's the one in higher position gives a blessing to the one in lower position. So Melchizedek blesses Abraham, and Abraham gives Melchizedek a tithe. He gives him this money to it. And so there's this picture of how Melchizedek is even greater than Abraham. The thing is, we don't know a whole lot more about Melchizedek. We learn that he has no genealogy, is the way it says. In other words, we don't know anything about where he comes from. Why does that matter? Well, because in ancient Israel, the only way you could become a priest is if you were from a certain family line. You had to be from the line of Levi, from Aaron's line. So you had to be from the tribe of Levi in order to be a priest. If you were from one of the other tribes, it didn't matter how much you wanted to be a priest. You couldn't. Well, Melchizedek has no genealogy. In other words, the lineage didn't matter. And in the same way, what the preacher, the writer of Hebrews is saying is the lineage doesn't matter for Jesus either. Let me give him my water. So we're going back. Melchizedek has no genealogy, no lineage. His lineage didn't matter for him becoming a priest. And it's important for the writer of Hebrews here because he's saying the lineage of Jesus is irrelevant for that because Jesus, if you think if he's a Jewish person, he would have to come from the tribe of Levi. But Jesus is not a descendant of the tribe of Levi. He's from the tribe of Judah. So you think, well, wait a minute, he's from the wrong tribe. He can't become a priest. And that's why the writer says, but no, he's a different kind of, he's the order of Melchizedek, which means his lineage doesn't matter. He's greater than all these things. So that's where Melchizedek all fits into this big thing. Melchizedek is the priest and king, the genealogy. And so he's getting to the point that Jesus, this is the big point, Jesus is superior to all the other priests that Israel has ever had. Jesus is not just any high priest. He's the greatest high priest ever. So that brings us back to those verses. So that's where the kind of this, we lead into this and we come back and we say, so then, since we have a great high priest who has entered heaven, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to what we believe. So we have the high priest who passed through the heavens. So Jesus, at the end of Holy Week, offers himself on the cross. He dies on the cross. But then the picture is, think back to how the priest, there would be a sacrifice outside the temple. Then they would bring the sacrifice in. And what would happen? The priest would come in, would enter into the presence of God and bring the sacrifice and present it before God. And so this language of Jesus passing through the heavens is the same way. He's offered himself and now he brings the sacrifice. And what's the sacrifice? Himself. He brings the sacrifice into the presence of God, his resurrected self, and he enters the presence of God. And then he says, this high priest of ours understands our weaknesses, for he faced all the same testings we do, yet he did not sin. So here he's coming back to that same idea. So Jesus, the high priest, has gone into the presence of God. And Jesus is a high priest who understands our temptations. This is one of the great things we understand, that Jesus is God in the flesh. But the way we understand it, he's fully God, but he's also a person. Fully God, fully human. And so he comes in and he understands what it's like to be tempted. It says tempted in every way. Now, does that mean Jesus faced every possible temptation? No, I don't think so. I mean, one is, he lived 2,000 years ago. Some of the temptations we face today didn't exist back then. Jesus couldn't be tempted to bully somebody on Facebook. He couldn't be tempted to hack into a computer and steal from your bank account. He couldn't be tempted to drop a nuclear bomb on someone or watch an X-rated movie. Those things didn't exist back then. But what we understand is though the expressions of sin have changed, the nature hasn't. There's greed, there's murder, dishonesty, lust, hatred, all those things. But I think really what the preacher is getting at here is a particular temptation in mind. I mean, he's thinking of all temptation in general, but he has one particular mind, and that's what he's been talking the whole letter about, is the temptation to run, the temptation to lose heart, to lose faith in the face of struggles, to maybe take the easy way out. And so there's two stories in the life of Jesus that kind of highlight. The first takes place early in his life. The gospel stories, the stories of Jesus tell us that early in his life, Jesus, after he was baptized, he went out, led by the Spirit of God, into the desert. And he's out in the desert or the wilderness. And there, it says, Satan comes and tempts him. Tempts him to turn stones into bread. It tempts him to throw himself off a high place and have God save him. It tempts him to, like, be given by simply worshiping Satan, to be given all the kingdoms of the world. In other words, he's asking him to what? Take the easy way, to bypass all those things. Because that last temptation thing, the last temptation there is to, if he just bows down and gives his worship to Satan, Satan will give him all the kingdoms of the world. Well, spoiler, at the end of the story, Jesus dies, he's resurrected, God raises him from the dead, and then what happens to him? God seats him at his right hand where what? He reigns over every kingdom of the world. Now, he had to go through suffering and death to get there. He could have just gone the easy way, right? He could have just at that moment said, Satan, oh, sure, Satan, go ahead. But he chooses the right way. So I like the way Philip Yancey says it this way. He says, as I reflect on Jesus' temptations, I realize they centered on his reason for coming to earth, his style of working. Satan was, in effect, dangling before Jesus a speeded-up way of accomplishing his mission. He could win over the crowds by creating food on demand and then take control of all the kingdoms of the world, all the while protecting himself from danger. That was the temptation to Jesus was, take the easy way, Jesus. Avoid the suffering. Avoid the persecution. Avoid the pain. And so I think part of what the Hebrews preacher is getting at here is that's the temptation. Jesus understands that temptation that we have to take the easy way, to run away from the persecution, to run away from the struggles, to run away from the doubts. And it comes also at the end of his life for Jesus, when he comes and he gets ready and he's just before he dies. And so I'm going to read a little bit from the Gospel of Luke. And this is the story that it tells near the end of Jesus' life. So this is after Jesus had a meal with his followers. He's gone out to the garden. This is in Luke chapter 22. It's on page 54 in the Immersed Bible. It says, then accompanied by the disciples, Jesus left the upstairs room and went as usual to the Mount of Olives. There he told them, pray that you will not give in to temptation. So here he is. He's telling his disciples, this is what you need to do. Pray. He says, he walked away but a stone's throw and knelt down and prayed. Father, if you are willing, please take this cup of suffering away from me. Yet I want your will to be done, not mine. Then an angel from heaven appeared and strengthened him. He prayed more fervently, and he was in such agony of spirit that his sweat fell to the ground like great drops of blood. And so in some sense we see, maybe we could call it a temptation, or at least a desire to avoid the suffering. To ask God, God, is there an easier way to do this? I mean, I want to do what you want, and I'll do that if I need to. But can you find an easier way? Could there be a way that I could avoid the suffering? And then we have the disciples. And he tells them, pray so you don't fall into temptation. What's he asking them to, what's the temptation? They go to sleep there, that's the temptation. But the big temptation is that in the coming days, when Jesus is arrested, what do the disciples do? Run. They run away. Why do they run? Because they're scared. Because they have doubts, because they're afraid of what will happen to them. They see Jesus being flogged. They see Jesus being put on the cross. They're like, oh, no, not me. And so Jesus says, you need to pray. So don't. And so Jesus, this is back in that passage for me, while Jesus was here on earth, he offered prayers and pleadings with a loud cry and tears to the one who could rescue him from death. And God heard his prayers because of his deep reverence for God. So now we come back to our key point, that we have a great high priest. So this is Jesus, the high priest, the great high priest, greater than any other. A high priest who understands what we go through, who understands what it's like to have friends turn on you, who understands what it's like to go through trials, who understands what it's like when life is hard, who understands what it's like when God calls you to do something and it's going to be painful, who understands what it's like when people mock you and make fun of you, who understands what it's like to face persecution. And then what the preacher goes on to say is, the fact that we have that high priest, the one who has entered and is in the presence of God, means two big things. The first one, since we have a great high priest who has entered, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to what we believe. He said, because we have this high priest, we are called to live our beliefs through the way we live. To claim Jesus as Lord, to give him our allegiance means committing our life. It's not just a phase we go through. It's not just words with our tongue. It's asking ourselves, is our faith God-centered or self-centered? Are we seeing ourselves focused on who God is, or do we just simply concern ourselves with him? He's saying, because we have this high priest, hold to your faith when you're discouraged, when you have doubts, when you're insulted, when your faith is slipping. When you're going through those times and you've been praying for someone and you feel like the prayers aren't answered. When you're going through a struggle and you can't make sense of what's life going on. When you see the world around and you're having doubts and fears about all these things and you're beginning to feel the slip away. He's saying, remember you have a great high priest. So hold to your faith. And so what he's inviting us to do is to say, do you have a picture in your mind of Jesus as a high priest? And not necessarily, I'm not saying Jesus dressed up in a fancy robe with all kinds of things, but Jesus as a high priest who is in the presence of God, praying for you, interceding for you. Now, here's where it gets even better. You think, well, that's good. I've got a high priest for me, so hold on to my faith. Well, the problem is when we hold on to our faith, it comes back to the cat poster, right? How long do you think, I always say, watch action movies and stuff, and the people jump and they're hanging on a cliff from their fingers. Have you ever tried to do that? Hang from your fingertips? No, and then they're they'll reach with one hand and grab somebody else. I'm like, just try for 2 seconds to hang by your fingertips. And here, back to why we're talking about that. Because in here it says Jesus, because he's as a high priest, it says hold firmly to your faith. But sometimes that's what it feels like. We feel like the people were hanging there. It's like, hold on to your faith. And I'm like, I can't. I don't have the strength. In other words, what Jesus is asking us to do is beyond the resources that we have. Well, absolutely. But there's good news. Because he says this, so let us come boldly to the throne of our gracious God. There we will receive his mercy, and what we will find grace to help us when we need it most. In other words, God doesn't simply say, when things get tough, hold on to your faith. And you're like, yeah, I try holding on, but I'm dangling, and I've got my family on this leg, and I've got all my checkbook on the other, and I've got my broken car that's hanging down there. I'm like, And God says to us, yeah, don't just focus on them. Focus on what the grace that I have when you need it most. So we come boldly to his throne. Let's go back again to the priests. And so when the priests, what happened? There was this temple with the center at the Holy of Holies, and God was hidden. And now, and only the high priest could enter. And so Jesus is the high priest, so we think, Jesus is the one who enters now. But no, this high priest says, doors are open. Come on in. So in other words, God isn't hidden from us anymore. But instead, we have access to God. And when we're struggling, and I want us to remember that, struggles are a part of the Christian life. Struggles doesn't mean you're doing something wrong, because this is the opposite of what we often think. Sometimes we think, if I'm struggling, there's something wrong with me, there's something wrong with my faith. He's saying struggles and trials and faith and doubt are all part of our Christian life. And so what he invites us to do is to draw near to God. And that's even counterintuitive. Because often what we think is when we're struggling, our tendency sometimes is to run away. So if we go back to the very first story in the Bible, it was Adam and Eve. And they're there, and they fall into temptation. They fall into sin. Do they go running to God and say, God, I messed up? No. What do? They run and hide. And it's the same way for us oftentimes. When we are struggling, when we are having difficulties, oftentimes the temptation is to run and to hide, to be afraid because we feel like we've let God down. And here's the writer saying, when you're at those moments, come and run to God. So Jesus, in his moment of trial, when he's there and he's facing this overwhelming moment where he's about to offer his life on the cross for the sins of the world, And he's starting to have questions and he's starting to wonder. He doesn't run away and say, God, I'm sorry. No, what does he do? He runs to God. And he pours himself out on it and receives mercy. This isn't a message of trying harder. It's a message to come into the presence of God and to receive help from the one who can help us. We are so ingrained, so built on this idea, and even this false idea. If I were to say this, and God helps those who what? No. No. God helps when we come to him and he gives it to us. It's not about us helping ourselves. It's us realizing we can't do it ourselves. That's the story of the Bible. We can't do it ourselves. Jesus dies for our sins because we can't do it ourselves. When we're struggling in our faith, we can't do it ourselves. So Jesus says, come into the presence of God and receive grace, and he will give you the help you need because you can't do it yourself. This isn't our natural response, but it's what we're invited to do, to come and to pray like Jesus did, and Jesus makes the way. So as we enter into this week, let's remember that Jesus is our high priest. He's the one who knows the temptation. So whatever struggles you're going through, whatever doubts you have, whatever wonderings, whatever questions you have, Jesus understands them and he knows them. And he doesn't look down on you. He doesn't berate you because of them. Instead, what he does, he invites you to come into the presence of God, to approach God, and he'll be there. He doesn't just stand outside the door. Jesus doesn't do the thing like, okay, well, here's the thing. You go talk to him. Instead, Jesus stands by the throne of God and says, come on in. I know what you're going through. I know the struggles. And I want you to bring your struggles, your doubts, your worries, all your fears to God and talk to him. Jesus, our high priest, invites us in. So let us come to God and give him all that we have. Amen.